Hello and welcome to Future Projection. This is episode 200 of the show. I am Carlos Collazo alongside Ben Badler. Congratulations, Ben. 200 episodes.
200. How does that feel? That feels good. Yeah. I don't know. It's a nice little milestone to hit before we probably take a few weeks off after to celebrate.
Yeah, regular listeners of the show know the calendar is about to turn into August, and so their expectations for us are probably quite low. But we mentioned this on last week's podcast episode, but the schedule for us is about to get a little bit more dicey as summer travel picks up. We're both heading off to some pretty high profile summer events on the high school side, which is fun. And then for me, I'm probably dragging us down a little bit more than is typical. I'll be off on vacation for 2 weeks after I go to East Coast Pro. But yeah, 200, once we hit 100, I feel like the only milestones that are interesting on the show are every 100 episodes or so. So in a couple of years when we get back to 300, I guess we can celebrate that as well. But
I thought you were going to say 500 or 1,000 next.
Yeah, you think the hundreds are just lame now? 200. I when we got to like 180 or so, I started looking ahead to 200. And I was like, oh, should we do something special for episode 200? And we're not. Maybe for episode 1,000, we'll have a special episode.
I didn't get you anything, if that's
what you're going for. Yeah, I didn't get you anything either. So
that's what you were hinting at.
We're on the same page.
I do have to, though, it brings me no joy to do this. I don't like doing it. But I do have to give you some credit here, Carlos.
Oh.
Because you did say, coming into the draft, maybe a week or two before the draft, you were saying that the player where there's like the most amount of volatility, where he might go, I mean, potentially higher, potentially lower, just like a wide range of outcomes that could happen for him. And that was Logan Schmidt, who was the Guardians' second round pick, who is, as you may have heard, not a Cleveland Guardian. In fact, we're not even sure, well, in part because he's not even really sure where he's going to go next. LSU commit did not sign. I mean, I don't even know if I call him LSU commit. He was committed to LSU. Now he's undecided if he's going to go to LSU or he's going to go to junior college, but he's definitely not going to the Guardians. We know that.
He's not, and this is also why it's a little... You can't always immediately react to a draft class because you don't know for sure who's going to show up. Every year there are a handful of players in the top 10 who don't sign a contract. This year we had just two, Logan Schmidt, the most prominent name, but also the Brewers had fifth rounder Aiden Kanak. He also didn't sign. So just two of the top 10. But yeah, the Logan Schmidt news, I can't say it was like, oh, I definitely knew this was going to happen, but there was just a lot of uncertainty surrounding his name as we approached the draft this year, both in terms of like where he was going to go, what the signing demands are going to be, like teams in and out on him down the stretch. Because I do think on talent, I mean, purely pitch for pitch, delivery, control, command, track record among these high school players, I think you can make a very compelling case that Logan Schmidt is the best pitcher in this class. Like if you prefer another guy like Gio Rojas or Carson Beaumont, like that's defensible as well. But I just think between the power of his fastball, the quality of his breaking ball, the quality of his changeup maybe would be the separator that I would push for him if you wanted to make a case for him as a top pitcher in the class. I do think having just the power, the spin, and the changeup as like a now present piece when you combine it with his youth, his frame, his delivery, in the command to tie it all together. I think it just on the field, it's a very well-rounded profile. And so it is a bit surprising to see this player not get signed because typically a player of this profile is one of the top high school pitchers that you see get inked to a deal. It doesn't happen for the Guardians. It doesn't happen for Logan Schmidt this year. Really curious to see like what he's going to decide to do moving forward. I guess it's not unheard of for players who don't get signed, who back out of a four-year commitment, go the JUCO route because they do want to get into pro ball, and maybe for whatever reason they didn't get the money they wanted, they weren't happy with the situation, something just went unexpected for them, and so they used the JUCO route, which is another reason why we talked about this a few weeks ago, but I really like baseball's draft process because there are all these varying routes you can use. And if you're really committed to going to pro ball, the fact that you can play 1 year at JUCO and try it again next year, I think is hugely beneficial for baseball players and just baseball's draft in general. But yeah, Logan Schmidt not signing. I mean, were you shocked to hear this, or was the added volatility that we were reporting before the draft enough to maybe open your mind to this possibility, Ben?
I think anytime, look, it's 98 point something percent of top 10 round picks signed. So
right,
we expect one or two of those guys not to sign, and that's what happened this year. But it is surprising. It's still surprising when you see the guy not signing, right? Whether it's
right.
Chris Lavonis before, right, from the Brewers going to Wake.
Yep.
Tyler Bell with the Rays going to
Angel
Kentucky.
Cervantes.
Yeah, Cervantes. And sometimes you hear, like, right after the draft, oh, like, this
right.
one might not get done.
Yep. So that was the case with Cervantes for us. I don't remember Bell off the top of my head if we knew right away, but with this one for Logan Schmidt, It definitely wasn't like as soon as he was drafted, I heard it wasn't going to happen. But there just always was a lot more noise than I expected to be around his name in the run.
Right. And then you look at the Guardians' bonuses and how they spent their money and the way the draft shook out. It's like if Logan Schmidt, I'm sure, was asking for money comparable to the top high school players in the draft, right? Okay, like we had Gio Rojas ranked as the top high school arm this year, calling Jared Grindlinger either an outfielder or a two-way guy, so set him aside. But okay, but everybody else, like Jensen Hirschhorn got $4 million. Coleman Borthwick got $3.8 million. You go a little bit further down, if you want to say he's maybe more comparable to like a Carson Bowman, who got $3.38 from the Giants. Carson Wachter got $3.2 from the Giants. For Caden Wachter from the Giants as well. Jack Slightem gets $3 million from the Royals. Blake Bryant, $2.75 from the Diamondbacks is the 40th the 40th signing overall signing bonus, 31st overall pick in the draft. So I imagine, I've heard Logan was probably looking for that kind of money, which makes a lot of sense. So, and that sounds like the price that he was telling teams. So if they took him there, I don't quite see how they could fit him into their bonus pool. Now, at the same time, if you're the Guardians, right. you could say, okay, well, we can take him. And if we don't sign him, MLB has kind of stacked the deck in our favor where we get a draft pick next year if we don't sign him in basically the same spot. So, okay, it's better if we sign Schmidt, but if we don't, there's a backup plan that's almost just as good.
Right.
And maybe he's asking for this price, but we can get him to come down from that price, right? Like this is a guy who was originally in the 2027 high school class. He reclassified up a year. And when guys are reclassing up a year early with like very few exceptions, I think of like Kate Curlin, maybe when he went to Florida, did this, but, and there's some other exceptions to this rule, but generally if you're reclassifying, you're not reclassifying so you can go play college baseball a year earlier. It's kind of an unusual high school situation with him. Like if they got the sense, which it seems like is true because he's not necessarily going to go to LSU. He might go to the junior college route. If they're looking at all that and saying, we don't really think this kid wants to play college baseball. We think he wants to sign, so maybe he's putting out this big number. We think this guy is maybe a back of the first round type talent who we can get here. Maybe we can get him to come down off his number. And if not, then okay, we get an extra draft pick next year. That's not a, I don't love like when a player doesn't sign because of a situation like this. Like it's a lot better when teams can be aligned on the numbers going in.
That's true. Yeah. From the player's perspective, it is pretty similar to just a player not getting selected overall, though. So there are players who, their bonuses are, I can't speak to like the details of the conversations that happened here, but there are plenty of players who potentially could go in the similar range you're talking about with all these arms, like where Logan Schmidt went in the second round, Sean Duncan at the back, Ethan Walkman in the third round, Jensen Hirschkorn in the third round. And all these teams are asking, like, hey, are you signing for this? Are you signing for this? There are a number of players who are getting those phone calls and they're just saying, no, like, I'm not going to. But it does feel worse when you actually get selected. Maybe your player, you think you're gonna get the number you put out, and then you start getting negotiated down. Again, I don't know the specifics and the details of that, but I would also say, like, heading into this draft, there are a group of pitchers who we kind of always expected to be selected and not get to campus. For me, leading up until I wrote that piece about his volatility, where I started wondering, okay, what is going to happen with him? Logan Schmidt, throughout the entire process, I mean, he had a really strong spring season. He was a player that I would have been shocked if he got to campus at LSU. I just thought the profile was too appealing to too many different teams, and he was at that tier of pitching prospect status, like a Gio Rojas, who's the top player in our class who did get the most money. Like, I didn't think there was huge separation from guys like Gio to Coleman Borthwick to Carson Bowman in terms of on-field talent. And so for Jensen Hirschkorn, I feel like how his spring went, I was much more of like, oh, I could see paths to him getting to campus in the run-up to the draft. He was in that, like, next tier, it felt like to me, at least in terms of the interest we were hearing from teams, from scouts who were on the ground watching them. Logan just seemed to have gone out and done it and performed at a level that most teams were really excited about. So it is just odd seeing how it all unfolds.
What do you think about the idea that he might not actually go to LSU and might go the junior college route instead?
I think if he thinks that's a better route for him now, I'm glad it's available to him. I don't really have too strong of takes. And I know from like LSU's perspective and his perspective too, there are probably a lot of NIL discussions and packages and money that's been, I don't know, like how much. I'm sure when Jensen Hirschkorn was signed, maybe the money that LSU is planning to push towards Jensen, you can just push towards Logan Schmidt. Like, one of them, maybe you're going to have a chance to. And so the finances are still there. But in terms of like deals,
they're
you're
pretty active
get,
in the transfer portal too. Like, those guys aren't
right
coming for free.
Right. If you're Logan Schmidt and you are really excited to get your pro career started, the JUCO route might just be better, because if he goes to LSU, he was a reclass from 2027, so he's not anywhere close to being a draft-eligible sophomore. It's not something where you can go to LSU for just 2 years, and maybe 2 years at LSU versus 1 year at JUCO. Maybe that's a conversation you could have, even if you're ready to get started. Maybe the benefits of either pitching against SEC competition or the resources you're going to have available at LSU, maybe that outweighs. But when you start to talk about one extra year as an amateur, quote unquote amateur, versus 3 years, because Logan Schmidt now, if he goes to LSU, he's not going to be eligible again until the 2029 draft, assuming that nothing changes in the CBA. So there's like a lot of assumptions we have to make here, but I don't know why we would assume all college sophomores will just be eligible, because there have been proposals about that. I think we should probably stick to what the current rule set is. Yeah, I mean, it could make a ton of sense for Logan Schmidt to say, hey, like, I believe in myself. Like, I believe in the talent. I'm going to go. I'm going to prove it again 1 year in JUCO, and then I'm going to sign. And maybe because he's going to be another year older, he'll be stronger. He'll face better competition. Maybe his big league ETA won't be that much different if it's just a year. But I think for pitchers, it's especially dicey because you need innings. You need to throw. You need to make sure you're not going to be pigeonholed into a reliever role or a piggybacking role. Logan Schmidt is talented enough that it would be surprising to me if he like fell out of a rotation at any school, including the powerhouse SEC programs. Like, I think he's that good of a pitcher. But you also have to worry about injuries. There's a chance you get hurt at some point that can impact your stock as well. So there's a ton of stuff that's going on and will be factors in the decision, financial, roster, just ETA, like what he's actually excited to do. And so I'm happy the JUCO route is an option. How about you?
Just the fact that he's deliberating between the two is a signal to me that, you know, he's not all in, obviously, on the college experience. And it makes a lot of sense to go the JUCO route, I think, for him. Like, I don't think going to LSU is going to be a bad decision for him if he wants to do that. But yeah, then you have to wait 3 more years to get a signing bonus. Whereas if he goes into the draft next year, it's basically the same as if he had just stayed in high school on his normal path, right? This would have been his normal draft year, but he reclassified a year ago to get into the 2026 draft. He'll go to junior college. Look, if he was a hitter, that might be different, but as a pitcher, you go to junior college, all the teams can go and just watch every start you make. They can evaluate your stuff independent of the hitters you're facing. If he dominates those guys, that will work even more in his favor. Teams will have all the TrackMan data they want. They can have him in for, you know, workouts before or to their facilities. So I think that works in his favor. And if we put him into the draft next year, we would have him still as a first round pick, projected at least at this point. Right. Like if you look at, I'm not going to put him in the tier of, like, you know, the upper tier college guys who've dominated at that level. Like, I know Dax Whitney is hurt right now, but Dax Whitney, Chris Lavonis, Lavonis.
No, I was looking at our board now. I don't know if this is the best comp because he'll still be in high school, but Logan Schmidt versus Connor Salerno, who's one of our top high school pitchers, left-handed pitcher. He's ranked fourth in the high school class, around 21 on our overall board. Like if he ranked right beside him, that's a pretty similar range to where we had him ranked in the 2026 class. That is a similar, like, first round evaluation that we'd have on him.
Yeah, those guys are the same age. We would marry them together, I think, right? Like, I think if you want to, like, you know, similar fastballs are both up to about 98 from the left side, 6'4", lefties who throw a ton of strikes, a lot of pitchability. I would give Salerno the edge on slider. I would give Schmidt the edge on changeup. But either way, you know, both guys have been dominant, but Schmidt also has been dominant against older competition because that's what we saw him do it all summer last year. So I'd probably give him the edge. So I wouldn't put him ahead of Dylan Seward on the high school side. But after that, like Lubin Rincon, shortstop, Jacob Seaman, an outfielder who's hurt right now. You know, those guys are 2-3, and then Salerno 4. Yeah, if he's looking at the board right now and says, okay, I go to junior college for a year, I might end up even better. I might end up being a first-round pick. And even if he doesn't, and he ends up signing for, let's say he ends up signing for $1 million, that's probably still a pretty good outcome for him. Instead of having to go to LSU and wait another, you know, 3 years to get drafted.
Right. The one element that is interesting, and I don't think it's something that you would need to metagame out too much because classes change year round. The 2027 college pitching class is incredibly deep, incredibly talented. There could be maybe a mild consideration of saying, okay, there's much more college pitching competition. Teams generally would prefer to take the college arms over the high school arms, like what the degree of separation would be for teams who are just seeing you in high school and then a successful JUCO season. I imagine somewhere between the two. You can't stack up the competition the same way, but you are going to be throwing more volume. There's going to be more data probably that you'll have at your disposal. But again, if we're talking about 6 months, 10 months down the line, how many of these guys are going to go out and perform? How many are going to back up? How many are going to get hurt? I don't think it's something that you would want to make your decision off of. And then also you mentioned kind of the JUCO route for pitchers compared to hitters. It is interesting just in recent draft history, how much or how many more arms we see in the first round coming out of junior college compared to hitters. We don't see first round junior college players a lot in general. In fact, in the bonus pool era, which is 2012 to now, we have only seen 6 first rounders.
Are guys like a Cam Collier, who's basically just like a high school guy who went to junior college, right?
Correct. Early. Like in a few years before the bonus pool era, one was Bryce Harper, 2010. Like he's not a conventional junior college player No, in many different ways. From 2013, we had Tim Anderson, who was a shortstop out of East Central. Junior college, he went 17th to the White Sox. And then we had pitchers Phil Bickford out of Southern Nevada in 2015. He was an 18th overall pick by the Giants. Then we had Nate Pearson in 2017 and Brendan Little in 2017. They actually went back-to-back, State JC of Florida and JC of Central Florida, kind of a fun year. In 2019, we had Jackson Rutledge out of San Jacinto, 17th overall to the Nationals. And then, like you mentioned, Cam Collier was a reclass, kind of unusual situation for him. And he was the 18th overall pick by the Reds in 2022. So four pitchers and just two hitters in this era of the draft coming out of junior college. It does seem like just a more viable route maybe for pitchers, or teams are more likely or more willing to take pitchers that high out of junior college compared to hitters.
Jacob Mizierowski too, and I mean paid above.
Yeah, I was just isolating purely for first rounders, but
yeah, but beyond the first round, teams are just not taking junior college hitters. Like almost none of them are getting drafted.
Yeah, and what was interesting this year too is I was looking at just kind of the demographics for this year's draft. It was the least drafted junior college draft ever, all time. Like, we've never had a draft with fewer junior college players in general than we did this past year, hitter or pitcher. I don't know if that's a trend moving forward, if that's something that is maybe just a blip this year. Maybe the JUCO talent wasn't what it typically is, or if teams are just increasingly not going towards that demographic for kind of like bulk players. Like, if there's an elite Cam Collier or Bryce Harper, those guys are still going to get picked regardless of where they're at. But I'll be curious if that's a continuing trend.
Well, if MLB says you have to wait 2 years after high school anyway, I mean, junior colleges are kind of, you're kind of screwed if you're at a junior college. Like, you're not getting.
Right. That removes drafted. The value for players. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's still, you know, it'd still be a valuable option as a stepping stone to another, you know, to a D1 program after that.
Yeah. Still valuable in the sense that, like, you want to play. That's how you get better.
Yeah. But if you want to get drafted out of there, that would be a blow for them.
I mean, from your vantage point, separating any kind of like what's best for Logan Schmidt, would you rather see Logan Schmidt suiting up for the Tigers and pitching with LSU? Or are you more interested in him going the JUCO route and getting him into pro ball quicker? What would be more fun from your POV?
I mean, if he goes to LSU, I'd like to see him pitching on TV all the time. Like, it's a lot easier to do that rather than follow whatever, you know, if he goes like a California junior college and try to follow his progress from there. Yeah. But I mean, he's got a couple of good options ahead of him. So yeah, I'm with you. I'm glad there is that option. I mean, I guess you could go like independent ball too, but I'm glad, although if MLB changes the rules, I guess you couldn't do that, but I'm glad there is that option to say, all right, well, I didn't like getting what the Guardians were offering me. All right, I have the option to go back next year if I want to go this route too.
Right.
Big second half of the season coming up. There might be a hot ticket, a rivalry series, a sold out experience that you need to get your hands on. And SeatGeek is the spot for that. You can find good pricing. They help you with the pricing. Green dot, good. Red dot, not as good. And they help you with your view of the seat for some big matchups coming up in August, September, and eventually leading up to playoffs.
Why would you not use SeatGeek? If you want to view from your seat, you want to know if it's a good seat, if it's a good deal, it has all of it on the app. It's easy to use. It's one click, boom. You buy the tickets, they send them right to you, you get them on the app, and then you can go check out whatever game, whatever you're a fan of, you can go to, whether it's baseball, whether it's concerts, whatever you're into, you can find a ticket, and you can always try to find the green dot on SeatGeek.
And for MLB tickets, you can get 10% off with that promo code we're running all season long, Territory10. That's Territory10 off your next set of MLB tickets at SeatGeek. Make sure you click the link in the description to download the app and have the code automatically added to your account so you can use it later.
Right. Okay, unless you have any more Logan Schmidt talk, I wanted to bring up briefly just the fact that the signing deadline is behind us. We can now look at the draft and kind of break down players from like just their actual signing bonuses. I think that's always useful, lining up the top 100 signing bonuses. We had this on the site. You can now look at the draft database. You can actually sort our full draft database by what players actually signed for if you want to either see kind of how your team lines up or how the overall draft lines up. Nearly half of the top 100 bonuses this year were high school players. I think the exact number is 44 of the top 100 bonuses were high school players. You can correct me if that's not the precise number. But did anything jump out to you this year in terms of the actual money players were signing for this year, Ben? Two of the standouts for me that jump out, if I can try and sort this sheet how I want it. So the first one, Jensen Hirschhorn, obviously taken in the third round. His essentially $4 million bonus was the exact same as fellow Braves draftee AJ Gracia at pick number 9. That was good for the 19th largest bonus in this draft class, which I think is just a great outcome for Jensen Hirschhorn. If you'd asked me prior to the draft, would Jensen sign for a top 20 bonus in this year's class? I definitely would not have said that he would, but good on him for getting that. And I still like the pick from the Braves perspective as well. We talked about this in the immediate aftermath of the draft. Their draft class in particular is just a lot of fun. And then at 23 overall, your guy, Aiden Ruiz, signing for $3.5 million in the second round with the Pirates, the same bonus as Ace Reese, who went 24th overall to the Mariners. I feel like those high school signings in particular stand out to me, and I believe they're the most notable non-first round picks who signed for first round money. A few other names to just maybe fold in here. Carson Bowman is technically not a first round pick. I think it counts as 29 overall. When I like to do like historic queries, I typically just do top 30 picks because we have so many of these kind of funky extra picks and picks falling. And then you also have Tyler Spangler, 36 overall, technically counts as a first round pick, but outside of that range. Cole Prosek, Kaden Wachter, and then Rocco Maniscalco kind of round out what a top 30 would be if you're purely looking at the money, which I think is more useful than the pick selection.
Yeah, it's just under half of the top 100 bonuses went to high school players. If you look at the top 50 players, it was a little bit more than half going to high school players. So when MLB talks about how, we'll get rid of the high school players because the teams want these college players anyway. Most of the guys they're drafting are college players. Yeah, because you're stacking the deck in favor of like volume of college players, obviously. But when you look at the top of the draft, and high school players in a lot of cases have more leverage than the college players do, but the teams certainly value the high school players. And I'd love to, not that we could like realistically do it, but have just a list that we could publish of the top offers that every player, both college and high school, received and then turned down. Because that what you don't see on the list of the bonuses is, this high school player turned down $1.4 million. This high school player turned down $900,000. This high school player turned down $1.7 million or $2 million in some cases. So those guys don't even show up because they just end up going to school. But the teams definitely value the high school players. So when MLB, especially like the owners or the commissioner, tries to spin it some other way, that is clearly not true. But yeah, some of the specific bonuses. I mean, I was surprised Zion Rose went as high as he did to the Royals, and to not get, he still got the 10th highest bonus. So they took him at 6, got him for the 10th highest bonus. Like, I'd have a hard time taking Zion Rose in the first round. Good prospect, but not at that level. That one.
Right, he signed for nearly $2 million more dollars than AJ Gracia, who you loved in that range, and we ranked in talent more on that range. We also, if you're like really interested in this signing bonus talk, one of the pieces that I've been doing the last few years after the draft is looking at the quote unquote best and worst values of the draft. And the process for that is essentially taking the slot values that MLB assigns from picks this year as 1 through 313. And we take our BA board and basically slap on those slot values to our players. It is essentially as a proxy to line up. How does the BA board value players in the system that MLB teams work with? It's not perfect. It's fairly crude. It's more crude than I would like for a number of reasons. I don't think that the talent is distributed in this like linear descending fashion. It also feels like the teams don't necessarily hand out slot bonuses for the very top players in the class. So even if those players would be getting much bigger bonuses in a free market system under this draft system, they're always like a little, I hate to say overvalued because I still think they're undervalued with what Rokcalowski is signing for in this system. But it's essentially a proxy to say, like, if you're going off our draft board, what picks are good values? What picks are bad values? And the two we just mentioned, you mentioned Zion Rose, that shows up as the, I think, sixth worst value. So the net difference in where we would have had Zion Rose pegged, if you're just strapping on slot values to the BA ranks, it's they paid basically almost $2 million more than we would have expected on our board. Whereas the AJ Gracia pick is one of the best values because he got $1.5 million less than we would have expected. So I can talk through some of those other picks as well. But I think that's just, it's an interesting exercise, and I would also come to it with a bit of humility. It is definitely not to say that like every one of these picks who are best and worst values we think are great picks. A lot of the times I think there are some picks that are made and I'm like, oh, okay, what does this team know about this player that I don't? Sometimes I think it's just maybe an aggressive pick. But I would definitely encourage you guys to check out that piece as well. It's fun to do.
Yeah, some of the other ones that jump out, I mean, Carson Wiggins with Mets at $3.46 million.
This essentially slot value for that pick. This was the number one worst value in that exercise. It was a $2.7 million difference in expected BA value and actual bonus. Like he was ranked just out of the 100 for us, so his BA value there would have been $762,000. It's a pretty big gap, and I think that one maybe worth talking about a little bit more. But I just feel like there's a lot of risk here for what you're getting with Carson Wiggins. I understand the arm talent is pretty elite, but I was very surprised to see that it's essentially a slot deal, right? I'm not talking out of turn here. I think he got exactly slot if you're factoring in the signing bonus contingency, and I certainly expected that to be an under slot deal when it happened in real time.
Yeah, big fastball. It's a good slider. I mean, he hasn't thrown many of them, though, because he hasn't thrown many pitches, period, in college because he's been hurt a bunch. I just think it's a reliever. I think these are, look, the Mets are not alone. I think this is a common thing that a lot of teams do, is they just overvalue what they see when guys are on the field and don't, I mean, as much as we talk about like projection, like projecting health is a big thing too. And like, what is the guy's role going to be because of it? So I just think there's a very high probability that he ends up a reliever. I don't think the track record historically of taking these guys who have these, that kind of medical and injury track record ends up working out favorably, especially like at a certain point. Yeah. All right. Love to have Carson Wiggins in your farm system. I'm not saying he's like a terrible prospect or anything like that, but then you look a little bit further down the bonuses and, you know, who they could have had after him. And it's like, all right, guy like Tegan Coons or Jack Riddell, getting or at least, you know, Riddell getting paid less than him. And actually, Riddell, what, one pick after him. So that jumps out to me. Brody Bamilla getting 2.75.
It's another one I was going to ask about because he was – Bumilo was maybe the biggest lightning rod player to talk about this spring. And he is maybe the epitome of the conversation you're talking about with teams maybe not factoring in health as much as they should. I was very curious to see where Bumilo was going to go, maybe more importantly, what he was actually going to sign for. But $2.75 million here in the third round. I will credit Texas. They took huge upside plays, which I think it's hard for me to fault teams that do that because I think the default strategy is to play things very safe and to avoid risky profiles. And so, like, while I am not the biggest fan of Bumilo for the risk factors that we've talked about that you're going to emphasize again here for some of the questions with spin, like multiple elbow issues at his age, it really concerns me. I also just kind of have to admire a little bit the willingness to take Gio Rojas and then follow it up with Connor Como and then follow it up again with Bumilo. It is certainly a draft that many directors, many GMs would probably not even feel comfortable, like they could get away with it from a job security standpoint.
Yeah, I don't love the decisions there. It's just a lot of risk. And I look, been at all of almost all of Brody Bumilla's starts that he's had in the last like 2 or 3 years. But when, I mean, for him to get that kind of money, given that he's already had a UCL surgery and now he's having a second one, like that's a great outcome for him to still be able to get close to $3 million. So like, I'm very happy for him, because it sucked the way his right. season ended, and it could have gone a lot worse if when just teams might being wary right. of the risk. But obviously, he probably would have got, maybe would have got double that had he stayed healthy. But to still get that much money, given yeah. the question marks, especially the medical stuff with him, is a tremendous outcome for him.
It feels hard to say that he would have definitely gotten more than Gio Rojas, but when he was healthy before that injury, when he was pitching well, I mean, we talked with a lot of scouts who basically had him neck and neck with Gio Rojas right behind him. He signs for 4.6. The next pitcher in the class, Jensen Hirschhorn, signs for 4 million. So I don't think it'd be crazy to say if he was healthy, he could have gotten potentially a 4 yeah. million or greater deal. Like that doesn't seem out of bounds at all for him. But I'm kind of with you in lockstep in how you're viewing Bumila specifically. I may be a little bit more excited about Rojas and Como in front of them for this draft class in particular. How about on the opposite end, some bonuses that we feel like are like maybe shockingly good values? I mean, the two biggest values according to our board are Sawyer Strohsnyder, who went in the second round to the Brewers, signed for $2.1 million, which is shockingly low to me. I don't fully understand how he even lasted that far on the board. We had him ranked as the number 13 player in the class, a top 15 talent. I thought even if he slid in the first round, he should still go in the first round. And I was like, oh, okay, we're hearing he might slide more, probably going to be somewhere comp. He slides far further than that. And then our second best value in the class, one of your personal favorites, Jacob Lombard, he slides down to the Marlins with their first pick at 14 overall. I think a lot of people expected that was going to be an overslot deal when it was happening, because he's this consensus top six player, consensus top 10 sort of talent. Yeah, we heard whispers of him potentially slipping, but it does seem like this was kind of like a, hey, we got to grab a spot. From Lombard's perspective, as an underslot deal there, he signs for $5 million. In terms of BA value, we had him as like an $8.3 million player. So both these guys are $3 million or more less than what we would have expected to sign if you're just slapping on the slots to our ranks. Any thoughts on these two? Should we be concerned with their profiles because of the slide? Is it just a case where we think these teams are getting excellent values and upside plays? I think for me, no doubt for Strohsnyder in the second round. And I'd be more open-minded to some Jacob Lombard skepticism because of his missed questions. But I know that is not where you land for him, Ben.
Yeah, no, I'm obviously a big Jacob Lombard fan. Like he just, you know, you compare him to Ethan Holliday, who had swing and miss questions in the draft last year and went, what was it, third or fourth overall to the Rockies and got the biggest fourth bonus overall, for yep. Yeah, I got the biggest bonus for any high school player in the draft last year. And Jacob Lombard is getting a little more than like 50% of what Ethan Holliday got. Like, I like Ethan Holliday. Maybe Ethan Holliday ends up with more power. Probably will, but Jacob Lombard, I think, has big power in every other aspect. I think Jacob Lombard is a better prospect than him. So I really like that pick for the Marlins, the fact that he's just like a hometown guy is not why they picked him, but like, it's a pretty cool aspect for obviously for
right.
Jacob, but also just for the fan base. Like anytime you get a local guy like that, it just like sweetens it a little bit extra. I think a lot of like the best value type picks are not going to be guys who show up on this top 100 bonus chart. It's going to be a lot of the,
right.
You know, like in the high school side, a lot of guys who go in like the later rounds where it's like, oh, the Pirates signed, you know, a guy like DeMarcus Rideout Carter, who's a right-handed pitcher from Canada for like a couple $100,000 in the 14th round. Okay, this is like a young right-hander, young for the class, up to 95, like some, you know, feel for a breaking ball. There's different guys like that. Cole Dennis, I think, with the Braves, a late round pick. There's a lot of, I think, especially a lot of arms in particular You know, I throw Josiah Kemp into that group with the Giants, who's an outfielder. A lot of guys are like, this guy's talent is not 10 or 15% of the talent of some of these guys that are signing for $1 million or $2 million or like $3 million. I would love to have a lot more of these guys of that value for, you know, $300,000, $400,000 or less.
I guess finding those high school players who are really talented that you really like or willing to sign for these $100,000, $200,000, $300,000, that is maybe the biggest separator in terms of like going out and scouting these players up, like getting a feel for who actually is willing to sign for that. Cause most of them, like you said, are players who are turning down that money and heading to college.
And that's a big part of where the area scouts are so important, because the scouting director and like their assistants, the cross checkers, they're not the ones who are in a lot of cases making those calls to those high school players. Like, yes, obviously for like Gio Rojas and Brody Bamillo, like, the area scout is involved, but scouting director is probably making a lot of those calls or somebody right underneath them. But when you get deeper down into the draft and you're looking for, hey, actually this high school player who we like a lot, who we scouted a lot this spring, like we know he's willing to take less money, and keeping in touch with those guys as the draft is going on, because your price on day one or in round five or round six might be one thing, and then all of a sudden the draft is getting later, there's a lot of pressure on you in the moment. Like, it's one thing for us to just like sit here and watch the draft unfold. It's another thing when you're it's you and you're the player and it's the heat of the moment. You're like, no. Like, I want to sign. I don't want to go to school. Like, I know we said this number, or I think I got bad advice from my agent. Like, I'm willing to drop it. If you're if you're an area scout and you're staying on top of the what you're doing, you can monitor that and take a chance on that guy.
And I think a lot of it too just happens even well before draft day, like getting to know the player, getting to know the family, trying to get a gauge of like, because players who are repped, especially, they don't want the players to talk about like where they don't want them to give up any sort of leverage they might have in the draft. So they're not talking about what their actual signability is going to be early on in almost all cases. It's almost always like, I'm sure the agents want like PR type answers, like, oh, well, I've got two good options, whatever's the best for me. Like, but the job of the scout is to try and get a sense of like, does this player actually want to go to pro ball? Is this player not interested in college? Is he not either academically oriented, or does he just want to start his pro career? Like, all of that is super valuable information that like being on the ground around the player, around the family, around the school, around the coaches, that's where you kind of find out that information. Doing the in-home visit, getting a feel for all of that, is super valuable. And it's hard to quantify maybe year round, but you can certainly quantify it on draft day for a lot of these deals. And so kudos to all the,
I had a player recently we were talking about draft stuff. He's like, man, he's talking about like where he might go in the draft. He's like, man, I really don't want to go to school. He's like, I'm done with school. So if you have those relationships with the players, you can get to know, he might be putting out this number, or the agent might be putting out this number, but like, we think like come day two, when it gets down to it, like, he'd be amenable to something more in our price range.
Right. Potentially bearing the lead here in the signing bonus conversation, but we did have the bonus record in the draft broken three times over. Rock Chalowski, Grady Emerson, Von Lackey, all signed for deals greater than our previous record of $9.25 million. Von Lackey at number three signed for essentially $9.5 million. Grady Emerson
is
has
that
the
inflation
new,
adjusted, or are you just going off real?
It's 9.4975. So I think with the signing bonus contingency, he'll be getting 9.5. Grady Emerson, new top high school signee, he signs for 9.7475 million. And then Rock Chalowski kind of blowing the draft record out of the water with his 10.3475 deal. What's maybe kind of insane about all these deals is, even with them all being record breaking deals, I guess technically you can't say Grady and Vaughn are record breaking now because of Rock, but
who signed first?
I don't know. I think Rock actually might have.
I think Rock signed first. Otherwise, Vaughn could have had the record for 8 minutes. Yeah.
The signed date I have is Rock first, and then Grady and Vaughn same day. But either way, Rock still saved, quote unquote, saved the White Sox $1 million towards their pool because the slot value for that pick this year is 11.3. He basically got $1 million under that and still broke the record by $1 million. Which tells you like how teams are operating with these slot values and how the slot values at the top are increasing. Grady Emerson saved the Rays $759,000 to his slot, and Von Lackey still saved the Twins $242,600 towards their slot. So it's still kind of crazy to me that these are all such record-breaking deals and they're still not getting slot value at the top. I think all these players are worth full slot value, but it is just a sort of leverage situation and like a cap situation that prevents them from getting that. Like if all three of these players are signing free agent deals, free market, all 30 teams can bid on them, none of them are going to be signing for less than $12 million, I would think.
Rock Chulowski is getting 10 times what he got.
He's getting a $100 million deal.
Yeah. I mean, it depends. Yeah. Like, all right, is it going to be like, look, like Yoan Moncada, who signed, and this was just as like a straight signing bonus, so not like he couldn't sign like a major league contract, but this was like, man, now I'm getting old, but this is what, like 10 years ago, getting close to it now, and he signed for just about $31 million with another $30, $31 million in tax, just as a signing bonus, not accounting for any future major league salaries that he was going to get.
Do you know if he got that $30 million right away? Is that bonus paid immediately, or is it paid in like piecemeal?
I think $30 million. I mean, yeah, I don't know exactly how he got paid, but yeah, he probably can pay it in like multiple installments over like a year or two, probably. But yeah, like you're not waiting around for 5-6 years to to get that money. That's so crazy. Like if these guys hit the open market, I mean, look at the contracts that got, like, you know, Roman Anthony. All right, fine. You know, some of these guys have major league time, or like how much money Christian Campbell got. Like, I don't know. these guys are getting a small fraction of what they would get if every team could bid on them.
Absolutely. Okay. Any other thoughts on bonuses signing day, or should we move on to some other combos here?
No, I got some travel coming up.
Both of us heading out for some big events. We got Area Code Games, East Coast Pro on the horizon. Maybe the two biggest summer events, I think, in my mind. They're the two I'd throw in. USA Baseball, their various national team events on the college and the high school side. Our typical ones, PG National, the PBR Invitational that you go to. East Cobb, like, we're kind of in the thick of summer circuit right now. These are the events that by and large are going to kind of drive the narrative for a lot of these high school players based on how they look at these events. It carries a lot of weight. I mean, Jensen Hirschhorn, who we just talked about, having a historic Area Code Games performance, I think probably went a pretty decent way into helping him secure that deal he got on draft day. So it is a crucial, crucial time for high school players on the calendar. And we're excited to be on the ground and watching both. You're going to Area Code Games underclass. We'll have Josh Norris and I believe Jacob out at Area Code Games upperclass, and I'll be on the ground for East Coast Pro, which maybe is my favorite event of the entire year. Can't wait.
Yeah, these are the two, if in the eyes of the teams, these are the two biggest scouting events on the entire calendar for the year. I mean, between now and, or between really any time of the year, like even including the scouting combine next year, any high school tournaments like the NHSI, whatever, like Jupiter, these are the two biggest ones for scouts, because the scouts are putting together these teams. So they're gathering, obviously, like East Coast Pro is almost exclusively guys in the eastern half of the country, divided into, what is it, like six, eight teams, something like that.
Yep. Yeah, like a Northeast team, a Deep South team, a Carolinas team, a Florida team, a Georgia team. Yep.
An Area Code is kind of the same thing, right? And they have an upperclass event, they have an underclass event. Most of the scouts are obviously going to the upperclass event to focus on the 2027 guys. And that's players right. from all over the country. Same kind of thing. Scouts are selecting the teams, running the tryouts, picking the players who are going there. They're in the dugouts with mm-hmm. the players. And every team is probably sending at least probably half a dozen scouts there. And then obviously yep. everything's on video, TrackMan.
And also the teams also have scouts who are running the teams, like the coaches on the team.
Right.
So they're in the dugout with the players, which I know for a few teams, I'm sure for every team that's super valuable, but just being able to like actually interact with players in game situations, I know has been super useful for teams when trying to figure out makeup or just competitiveness, get a sense of who the players are in like an actual game situation that you don't always get. I know that is another aspect of this that's just super cool for the team side.
And for the first half of the summer, these teams are mostly focused on guys for the current year class. Like there's other events going on that I think are really important to be able to cover, that USA has, Perfect Game, PBR, other games where you can, and environments where you can see these players. But for most scouts, the first time they can really sink their teeth into these guys is Area Code's East Coast Pro. And when you hear like a scout somewhere talk about what a guy did on the circuit last summer or how he looked last summer, in most cases, they're talking about how he looked at East Coast Pro or how he looked at Area Code games. Like everything else is just like,
right.
On side the periphery.
Shows. Yeah.
Yeah. Which it shouldn't be the case, but it just shows how much weight is put on those events. And it is like, they are very valuable events. Like I think they are the best events out there for players yes. and for scouts to be able to evaluate these players. You're also seeing them against the best competition.
Right.
Possible. It's a very, some of the other tournaments, you get a little bit more variance in terms of all right, well, this guy's throwing 88 or less right. than that.
Because these are events that are not pay to play events, you're invited. It's scout, like you said, they're scout run, they're scout. Like to get on the team, you have to be invited to a regional tryout. You try out, scouts pick the final teams, you get invited. You get supplied uniforms if you're the player. So it's not like something you just sign up for, you play your entry fee and anyone can go. So the fact that that's the selection process lets you know that they're all high priority targets from the team side. So the player quality is exceptional. You don't have the sort of bottom end that you might get at larger events or events that any team can kind of sign up to go play for. It's also very much geared towards evaluation. So how all of the pregame works, how the BPs work, how the workouts on field work, everything is designed for you to get extensive looks at these players, how they move in the field, how they throw, how they run, how they hit in BP. And then, like you said, obviously the most important thing, it's the most elite players in the country playing against one another. So those matchups, if you're a hitter and you succeed in these events, it is like tremendously valuable for your stock because everyone comes into these events knowing it's an incredibly hard event to hit at. Any event where you're not really facing the same pitcher a second time, it's going to be more difficult. The expectation is almost that you don't find success. So if you're a hitter and you go out and you go 3 for 6 at an event like this, it really does stick with those teams. I think more than another event because you're going to be doing it against almost every single pitcher is someone who could be drafted next year. Obviously, not all of them are because of just the signing bonus demands. But everyone is legit. Everyone is going to be committed to playing at a premium program. And so, yeah, it's tremendous. I can't wait.
Yeah, it's and the underclass one is important too, obviously for, it's run by MLB scouts, but that event is really where a lot of the college coaches, like the top college coaches all around the country will come in there. Cause you just come in, see all of the top players around the country where, okay, the event starts July 31st and then recruiting for the official time when you can start contacting recruits in that 2028 class, which yeah. is the players you're seeing, starts August 1st. So you can get a really good look at a lot of the top recruits in the country, and pretty much everybody Absolutely. At this stage is uncommitted. So
any player or players you're most excited to see?
I've seen in the 28 class, I've seen pretty much all of our top guys, but we do have a new number one player on our 28 class. Yeah. So I'm excited to see Flip Waters.
What a name, by the way. 80 grade name.
Yeah, Flip Waters, outfielder. He's from Michigan. So I've seen him this summer. He really jumped out. He's the younger brother of Beano Waters, who is the outfielder who's really good at Notre Dame the last couple of years, transferring to LSU this year, one of the top transfers in the country. Could be a top 2 or 3 round pick next year, just based on where we have him on the board. And as good as he is, Flip looks even better. I mean, 5-star recruit. He's big. Like, seeing him in person, just how physical he was stood out. Like, probably 6'2", 6'3", really strong already. And he can really run, like, 6'4 and change runner. So he's a plus-plus runner. Athletic, like, built a little bit more like a center, or excuse me, like a corner outfielder, but he certainly can run like a center fielder. And a really, really good swing, makes a lot of contact. He's got big power, bat speed, like, checks a lot of boxes that you're looking for a premium guy at that age, at 16 years old, to be a potential first round pick. I think the 2028 class overall is not as defined at the top as we've had in some recent years, where there's been like an obvious one or an obvious like group of like one or two guys at the top. But he certainly fits a lot of the things that you're looking for somebody at the top of the class.
Yeah, he sounds exciting. It's good to know there's some real tools to go with the name tool that he has. I feel like for me, I'm mostly excited to bear down more on some hitters who I know are really toolsy, who I just haven't seen too many ABs from just yet after seeing a little bit of USA. So, I mean, while a lot of these events, the pitchers are going to be quite obvious. Like, I remember watching Connor Salerno at East Coast Pro last year this time and being disappointed to find out that he was an underclassman because he absolutely looked the part and dominated. So there are going to be some of those obvious pitching performances, but the guys who just kind of steadily perform or just getting a chance to see more defensive opportunities from players, that's always really nice too, whether it's in a workout environment or in games. There's always a number of standouts, and mostly just excited to start getting a better feel because this is kind of the point in the calendar for me where all of my bandwidth can now go towards the 27 class. After signing day is over, after we get our kind of final coverage on the immediacy of the 2026 class, it's like, okay, now I can fully focus and fully start to try and just learn and see a lot of these guys in more depth and detail. It's like a freeing feeling for me, Ben. I know you've been watching a lot of these guys for multiple years now that I'm just now turning the page to, but it is always a nice kind of refresher. It gets you fired up again because it's a whole new slate of players for me. In the process of figuring those guys out and watching them perform and see who takes steps forward, who maybe surprises, who jumps on the radar. Because there'll be players at some of these events that either you were lower on or didn't know as much about who make a name for themselves. And it's definitely a continuous process of kind of following and tracking these guys. So it'll be fun.
You can tell me all the guys you think I overrated.
There are always a few guys who I either because I just see good looks or you saw bad looks in the past, I'm like, hey, what do you got on this guy? And we're like, I don't know. So maybe that'll be good conversations for the podcast moving forward.
Well, that always is part of the process for any scout or club too, where it's like you see a guy on the right day and he has just the best day of his life. Like if it's just like a tooled up guy and he happens to go off in one game, and you're like, wow, what, this guy's awesome. And then you're like, oh, actually, all right, fine. Give him another month of watching this guy, and then you'll see why we have him where we have him.
Right. Absolutely. Cool. All right. That's all I have, Ben. You got anything else?
No. It's a good episode, Carlos. Another great one.
Yeah. Fun episode. We are
200.
As we close out, I think this weekend we're also going to be running a deal at Baseball America. We rarely run these. So if you're thinking about subscribing to Baseball America, You haven't pulled the trigger, or your subscription is maybe coming up or came up and you just haven't re-upped, definitely check out the site this weekend. I believe through the trade deadline is when we're running this deal. I think it's a 30% discount on a Baseball America subscription. So definitely check BA, check the sign up page. It should just be trade is the code you'll plug in to get that discount for us. But all the details will be on the Baseball America sign up page. Definitely check that out if it's something that you've listened to us and you've thought about it, you've considered it. We've got tons of content year round, but with trade deadline coming up, with prospects moving around, we'll have all sorts of analysis there.
An underslot deal for you. Yeah.
Yeah. Get an underslot deal. It'll be the best value move you can make this summer. So check that out. And otherwise, thank you guys for listening to the show. Thanks for supporting Baseball America generally. And like we said, we'll have a mailbag episode next Tuesday that you can look forward to. After that, it will be a little bit more scattered in terms of our upcoming schedule. So just know that that is going to happen. Once we both get back from our travels, it should be pretty steady moving forward into the fall. But for Ben, I'm Carlos. So long, everybody.